This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk, with Don Sola. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Sola on AM 790 WPRV.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program. I don't know, Maya came in here and she swung the microphone boom so far away. It was all the way on the other side of the room. And I realized, like, here we go. The jingle music starts. I'm like, hey, wait a minute. Where's the microphone? It's gone. She's hiding it from me all of a sudden. Okay, so she's having a bad day. She always takes it out on me. What can I tell you? Well, we didn't have a bad day, really. I mean, the market actually could have been even a lot better than it turned out to be, although it was kind of an okay day. Anyway, stocks ended mostly higher. Interest rates slipped from multi-year highs seen in the previous session. The Dow closed about 164 points higher, although it could have been as high as 350 at one point. The S&P 500 gained about 0.1%. Also, well off session highs, and you know, the NASDAQ was actually down a little bit, about 0.11%. Although, like I said, for most of the day, these things are all in positive territory. The major averages gave up what were pretty solid gains from Wednesday after a summary from the Federal Reserve's January meeting sent the benchmark 10-year U.S. note, the yield, to its highest level we've seen in 4 years now. The Dow closed 166 points lower, having risen as much as 303 points at that stage. Today, the yield traded off its four-year high at around 2.923%. Now, the minutes from the Fed meeting convey a little bit of a clear sense that inflation is more on their minds than perhaps the Open Market Committee statement was indicating. Now, that's according to analyst Stephen Blitz. He's a chief U.S. economist at T.S. Lombard Company. He sent that out in a note to investors with the company, and the minutes gave readers conviction that only a sea change will actually stay the Fed from potentially 4.25 rate rises. In other words, a quarter of a percent each time for a total of four rises would mean that during 2018 they'd raise interest rates 1%. Now, one might think that that kind of trajectory puts the Fed behind economic activity. But, you know, market odds setters still actually literally very much lag the Fed in real time. They're pricing in about a 25% chance of four hikes this year. Now, my expectation for this year, 2018, given the little bit of carefulness or that they're having, I think they are concerned, looking back at the history of the Federal Reserve activity, that in an environment like this, if they raise rates too fast, too often, they will very likely not only slow the economy down, but actually push us into recession. We're not predicting a recession here in 2018. Matter of fact, a number of economists that we've been talking to lately are suggesting we may not see an actual recession, even though we tend to get one every 10 years or so. We may not actually see one until about 2021, which is a good 3 years from now. Now, remember what a recession is. A recession is technically when we've had two quarters in a row or 6 months of activity where the economy is actually shrinking instead of growing. Now, it doesn't have to shrink a lot. It could shrink marginally. But the fact that it's not growing and it's maintained that trend for at least 6 months suggests that it's more than just an aberration. The last recession we actually had was 2007 and 2008. And it didn't cause, but it contributed to, or shall we say exacerbated, the market bear market that occurred at the end of 2008. Earlier this month, stocks suffered their first 10% pullback, which technically is a correction, right? A 10% drop from the high. The first 10% pullback since early 2016. The Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ all closed in correction territory on February the 8th. Which means they would have dropped at least 10% from the high, which was on January the 26th of this year. But very quickly recovered most of those losses. As of yesterday's close, The NASDAQ had actually regained about 62% of the losses that it suffered. NASDAQ going to be dominated by the technology and growth companies, which of course went up the most, but also tend to correct aggressively when that does happen. The S&P 500 and the Dow actually had jumped about 40% and 35% respectively. But according to Randy Frederick, who's Vice President of Trading at Charles Schwab, he thinks that the market may have recovered a little too fast from its lows. He says that when you recover that fast, that usually opens the door for another downturn. Well, I don't know that that's viewed as a recovery. I remember what they said. They said as of yesterday, Wednesday, the NASDAQ had regained 62%, and the S&P and the Dow were up 40 and 35. That means, for the most part, other than the NASDAQ, the blue chips haven't recovered half of what the decline that they had they had experienced. Now, in corporate news, Chesapeake Energy shares jumped, after the company reported better than expected quarterly earnings. We're still seeing a lot of earnings numbers coming in, and they're still beating estimates, which gives you a nice snapshot of what's actually happening in the overall market and the economy. The stock was also the best performer in the S&P 500 for the day. Roku's stock shed about 20% after the streaming company issued weaker than expected revenue guidance for the current quarter. Now, one of the things that we've talked about here on the Money Talk program, and actually we've talked about it for a while, is that the stimulus that the Federal Reserve has been pushing into the U.S. economy, literally coming off of the bear market in 08 and moving into the recovery period that followed, the stimulus that was put into place fell into the category of what we call quantitative easing. Quantitative easing came in the form of a couple of things. Number one, it's keeping the Fed fund rate, which is the rate that the Federal Reserve charges its member banks for money. They kept that rate very low historically, which gets passed through the system. The other thing, too, would be by buying bonds in the open market, buying, in this case, treasuries and mortgage-backed securities in the open market, which, when you're buying $85 billion a month, which was the level they were doing under quantitative easing, that's a pretty substantial amount. And what it does is it actually creates the market itself. It means that the Federal Reserve was the principal market maker for those financial instruments, in general. I mean, who's going to compete with $85 billion a month? What that does is when there's that level of demand, it pushes the value of the bonds higher because, the demand for those bonds is higher. But when the value of the bond is rising, the underlying yield, the interest rate yield, drops, because these are called fixed income instruments. That's what I mean. The fixed income, the dollar amount stays the same. But if the value of the bond is rising, then you're dividing the dividend or the dividend, the interest payment into the value of that bond. And, of course, that means with a rising rate and the dividend staying the same as a fixed income instrument would, that means that the yields will drop. Now, if the yields are dropping, it means the cost of money is going down. Interesting dynamic for investors. Now, it can work the other way. When you go to unwind that environment, like we've seen now, I mean, let's face it, when they're buying bonds in the open market, they're adding those bonds to their balance sheet at the Federal Reserve. Now, the cost of money is getting cheaper, which is a great thing. People are out there refinancing mortgages and doing all kinds of cool things. Corporations are doing the same. Corporations don't have to issue bonds at as high a dividend because the competitive yields are much lower in that environment. So it's cheaper for individual corporations, companies to actually raise money through their own bond offerings as well as borrowing money in the open markets. That all stimulates the economy, and it's what pretty much has been driving this economy for the last 7 to 9 years. Not aggressive, it's not overly impressive, but what I'm saying is when you're getting 2% growth steady, the economy responds to that. The markets have been going up along with that. In addition to the markets rising, you also see unemployment dropping. The only thing that didn't really benefit from it was wages. So we didn't see much in the way of household income rising during that period. So that's something that we still had to work on. But overall, the economy was good, the market was good, and we've seen pretty steady upwards movements in stock prices literally since the middle of 2009 through the present. So are we looking for any sudden inflation in this environment, a sudden recession? In my opinion, in order to get a real bear market in this environment, you'd have to move into a recessionary environment. And as I mentioned earlier on, most of the economists we're talking to don't think that that's in the cards right now. Hey, folks, I'm Don. So I got a little bit of a cold, so if you can hear it in my voice, I apologize for that. But I'm trying to keep from choking too much with that itchy throat. This is the Money Talk program on AM 790. I'll be right back, so please stick around.
Sponsored by Page Publishing. Have you written a book? Learn how to get it published and potentially sold online and at bookstores. Call Page Publishing now for your free book publishing kit. 800-470-4833.
With the Bloomberg Small Business Report, I'm John Tucker. The Florida school massacre is once again focusing attention on the nation's thousands of independent gun stores. According to the Miami Herald, the owners of Sunrise Tactical Supply, the shop in Coral Springs that authorities said in November sold suspected shooter Nicholas Cruz the AR-15 assault weapon that was used in the massacre last week, has been closed indefinitely. Their attorney said both owners are distraught, that they're scared, not just for their safety, but more importantly, about how their reaction is going to be for the rest of the community as they try to re-enter it. The owners of the business, located in a strip mall near the school, said they made sure that Cruz filled out all the required paperwork, which included his driver's license and assurances that he did not suffer from mental illness. The store owners say, through their attorney, that Cruz purchased only the semi-automatic rifle off the shelf and did not buy any accessories, modifications, or ammunition so as not to raise any eyebrows. And that's the Bloomberg Small Business Report.
All money managers may seem pretty much the same. But while some money managers may recommend high commission investment products, Fisher Investments avoids them. Some money managers may have hidden and layered fees. Fisher Investments never does. And while some money managers are happy to earn commissions from you, whether you do well or not, Fisher Investments fees are structured so we do better when you do better. In other words, we're structured to be on your side. Maybe that's why most of our clients come to us from other money managers. Talk with us and find out why so many experienced investors are switching to and staying with Fisher Investments. Fisher Investments, clearly better money management. Investments in securities involve the risk of loss. Visit us at fisherinvestments.com to find out what we can do for you.
Hey, my name is Brand. You ever make a change and then wonder, why didn't I do this a long time ago? That's what's happening for thousands of people with regard to their health care. They're joining MediShare, and then they're wondering, why didn't I already do this? For most members, it costs less than half what they were paying for their old health plan. There's a huge provider network, too. You can customize your plan, and this is awesome, MediShare members can go online with a doctor 24/7, so if you need a prescription for the flu or something, it's so convenient for you and your family. So yeah, this is one of those why did I wait on this things. And if you don't love your current health plan, you're not stuck with it. You can join MediShare anytime. By the way, to give you an idea, the typical savings for a family, about $500 a month. It just makes so much sense. Check it out. They're super easy to talk to. Call 866-88-BIBLE. That's 866-88-BIBLE. 866-88-BIBLE.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program, everybody. Before I went to the break, I was mentioning that one of the issues that we've had some concern about over the last couple of years is that as the U.S. economy took on more and more debt, as the Federal Reserve built its balance sheet from what originally was close to $500 billion early on, but by buying back shares in the open market of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, they were increasing their balance sheet rather dramatically. Now, granted, there was a purpose for doing it, and I understand that, but at some point, an aggressive policy that's intended to provide stimulus to the economy, at some point you have to unwind that policy. Now, in this particular case, as with any assumption of debt, which is what happens when the Fed is borrowing money, essentially, to take that on, they get a $4 trillion balance sheet at some point with all these instruments on there. Now that's all stuff that has to be unwound at some point. And as they unwind, the reverse happens. Remember, I mentioned if they're buying bonds, then the yields are going to go down because the value of the bonds are rising. The dividend yield drops. It's a reciprocal relationship. The other way around is if they start selling bonds, trying to unload that rather large balance sheet that they're holding. Ultimately, what happens is there's a major demand for selling that will push the price of bonds down. And when the bond prices are dropping, that fixed dividend yield will cause the yield to rise. So that makes money more expensive, and it creates financial inflation. So inflation is something I've been kind of talking about a little bit, warning investors that, you know, for the last year or two, in fairness, so I guess I'm premature. But I think that the logic behind one of the financial risks we face as consumers and as investors, it's somewhat logical that that you should be at least thinking about inflation, if not immediately, but at least in the future. Here in 2018 is the first time I'm starting to really hear other analysts and economists and professionals talk about inflation. Now, it's not just a domestic thing here in the U.S. It's happening worldwide. So global inflation apparently appears to be finally on the rise. The bond market has apparently declared anyway, but the data do not yet firmly point to that conclusion, suggesting the low trend in place really right now since the financial crisis may linger for a while. So if they're going to unload bonds globally, or if inflation is going to pick up, it's going to pick up in a very benign and relatively slow fashion, which should have very little real impact on the bond market, which is what some people are worried about. But what the U.S. bond market appears to be reacting to, as well as a sort of a different kind of worry, maybe a little bit different than normal, is notably trillions of dollars worth of extra debt that's actually finding its way into the U.S. Economy, extra debt the supply to, you know, digest from, a U.S. administration that has cast pretty much aside any fiscal restraint related to both tax cuts and new spending. So $1.5 trillion program of tax cuts and $1.5 trillion infrastructure spending program. Well, folks, that's $3 trillion. I mean, we're talking about real money. When the government is borrowing money to make those types of commitments, what they're doing is they're taking that piece of the pie that we call the budget, you know, the federal budget, the piece of the pie that's allocated to debt service, which means interest payments and, you know, rolling over the debt when it comes to maturity. That costs a lot of money. And that piece of the pie, in other words, the piece is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And as that piece of the pie that represents debt service gets larger, that means that other pieces of the pie, which may be critical, entitlement programs such as Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, which have always been thought of as being sort of sacrosanct, are suddenly people are looking at them with a skewed eye, saying, hey, you know, maybe we should be, these are among the bigger programs as part of that budget. Maybe we should be thinking about cutting Social Security retirement programs, or so, who gets what. Or they're probably a little bit reluctant about doing that, but the next move anyway would be to try to find new sources of revenue. And that probably means take the amount of money that comes out of the average worker's paycheck and increase that from the roughly 7.65% that it has under the FICA rules currently, increase that up to maybe 9 or 10%. Again, making the average individual's net take-home pay smaller. But regardless of all that particular discussion, this issue of inflation as being an issue is one that I thought would probably be more notable a year or two ago, or certainly the issue, the effect of all the fiscal stimulus, the monetary stimulus we've been looking at, would probably not be an issue. But apparently the monetary stimulus was only one thing, but now fiscal stimulus, which is the things done by government, by the Oval Office, and by the legislature in the House and the Senate, you know, these are the things that we worry about, because they say somehow, some way, these things have to be paid for. And we don't seem to have anybody who's in Washington right now who's particularly responsible fiscally. In other words, there was a time when the Republican Party was known for not wanting to take on these types of additional extraordinary debt. Yet all of right now, they're like a bunch of drunken sailors. And the Democrats were the ones who routinely were known for being willing to borrow money and spend money on entitlement programs. And now it'll be odd to see just how, whether they become the party of restraint and conservatism, at least fiscal conservatism. For all the optimism about a sort of a punchy global economic upturn, in which an exceptionally long list of countries are expanding at the same time, the two biggest central banks right now are due to keep running completely opposing policies this year. Faced with robust U.S. growth and now a sudden huge amount of fiscal stimulus, whether it's infrastructure spending or whatever, in the pipeline, the Federal Reserve is likely to actually raise interest rates. And we suggested three times in 2018, although there's been some argument about whether they would do it four times. I still think it's three. With rising speculation for the fourth hike, before the year is out. Right now, there's about a 25% chance of that happening. I don't think that that's a good chance. But the European Central Bank, trying to generate inflation out of a Eurozone economy that is now booming by any historic measure, reasonably, but they're still trying to generate inflation. It's still pouring on the stimulus. They're following what we did. We did QE 1, 2, and 3, quantitative easing. They didn't start doing it when we did. They and the Bank of England and Eastern, the Asia-Pacific markets, they all kind of sat back and watched us to see, well, geez, they're doing this, quantitative easing thing. I wonder whether this is going to work. Let's watch. Well, they started doing it themselves a short while ago, but they're much later in the cycle. We've already completed our stimulus programs, and they're still in the midst of doing their own, which may mean there's still more economic activity, maybe even more market activity available outside the U.S. than there might be domestically inside. But anyway, they're still active with their own quantitative easing, and they're buying about 30 billion euros of bonds a month. That's through September, at least. It's not likely to raise interest rates until well into 2019, so you're not going to see that happen overseas. Now, part of the ongoing sharp divergence in policy, of course, is because the U.S. economic expansion is more mature now. And at about 4.1% unemployment level, unemployment is close to the lowest that it really can go, and so is more likely to actually push up inflation through higher pay structure. In other words, for companies to hire new people because they want to grow their businesses, the demand is coming in, or they hope it will be, and they want to expand their capability to service that new business. What are they going to do? They have to hire people that already have jobs. In order to do that, you're going to offer them a higher pay than what they're already earning. People hate change, They don't like change. So in order to get people to accept and embrace change, they have to give them a financial incentive to do so, which is usually a raise. But for two similar consumer-based economies, their core inflation rates, at least so far, are forecast to also remain similar and historically low at this stage. I mean, even if we raise interest rates here in 2018 three or four times, it's still historically low numbers. The latest Reuters survey of private sector economists, taken maybe this last week, they show that no change to the inflation outlook across major economies at this stage. Not a single respondent to the survey had 3% or higher for U.S. core PCE inflation. The measure that the Fed targets at around 2% this year and maybe next year. The median for 2019 has been really stuck at around 2% since monthly polling started about 9 months ago. Of course, that doesn't mean there's no chance of a sudden acceleration that nobody might have seen, but several analysts who have delved deeply into recent U.S. employment data history and the prospect for a surge in wage inflation are recommending a little bit of calm out there, so not to worry too much about it. But inflation is a big issue. It's something we have to pay attention to. It's something that anybody managing portfolios, investments of one sort, must build some element into their investing thought to cover, to protect, or to take advantage of inflation that may emerge within the domestic as well as global economies. Hey, I'm Don Sowa. You're listening to the Money Talk program here on AM 790. It's your home of talking business. It's halftime on the show, and we're going to take a quick break, so I'll be right back.
I'm talking honest pricing with your local roofing, siding, and window expert, Tom Marshall of Marshall Building and Remodeling. Tom, what can you tell homeowners right now who are thinking about having a new roof, siding, or windows installed in their homes?
Well, as you know, Matt, some manufacturers have already raised their pricing for spring, and now Mastic and CertainTeed, the country's two largest, have announced price increases in the next 4 to 6 weeks on all roofing and siding. So anyone thinking about this type of work should at least get a free estimate and take advantage in saving money now. Lock in a price and schedule for spring or summer. And I have to say, Matt, whether the people call us for the estimate or someone else, it just makes good sense to call now.
You couldn't be more honest than that, Tom, and you're right. If you need new roofing, siding, or windows, and you want to save some money, why hold off? Call and get that free estimate from a company you know and trust. And remember, with Marshall, you don't pay anything until your work is complete. So do what my family did and call Marshall Building and Remodeling today. 800-866-1499. That's 800-866-1499. Or visit MarshallBR.com. Tell them, Tom.
We're your local roofing, siding, and window people.
Earnings vary based on your effort. Message and data rates may apply.
Do you want to learn how to make money flipping houses right here in Providence? If so, we have an amazing opportunity for you. We're looking for a small group of motivated individuals to join our real estate investing team. You'll learn our simple three-step system for flipping homes right here in the local area. This is Than Merrill, star of A&E's hit TV show, Flip This House. My team and I are looking for a handful of people in the Providence area who want to learn how to make money flipping houses in your spare time using other people's money. Providence is a perfect market for my system, and next week, I'm holding a free 2-hour educational workshop where you will learn how to make money flipping homes and how to build long-term wealth with income properties.
To get 2 free tickets to Than's workshop, text FAST to 82,000. Seating is extremely limited. Text in the next 10 minutes and you'll also receive a free copy of Than's Money for Deals guide. Text FAST to 82,000. That's FAST to 82,000.
Home foreclosure can be a nightmare. A couple of missed house payments, and before you know it, your house is being sold right from underneath you. You don't know where you or your family are going to live, or even where you're going to spend the night. If you don't think it can happen to you or anyone you know, think again. You don't have to face this alone. Certified housing counselors from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling are available to work with you and your lender. And this service is completely free. The sooner you call, the better your options. Call 866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org to request a free consumer education DVD called Avoiding Foreclosure, Working with a Certified NFCC Housing Counselor. This nightmare does not have to happen to you. That number again, 866-687-6322, or visit mortgagehelpnow.org. This has been a public service message from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program. Well, I did get a question that someone asked that contacted us via the website and said, could you please address this issue on your Money Talk program? Ordinarily, I would probably try to use this as part of a Get Back to Basics program on a Tuesday with Donna. But I said, well, that's several days away. So let's take a whack at it here while we can. Since it was something that is timely that young people and millennials are dealing with, this one dealt specifically with student loan questions in terms of how does payment of a substantial debt to education, tuition funding, and student loans, how does that work? How can I most efficiently deal with this as part of my overall financial plan? So let's deal with a specific question, a specific case, and we'll see how the financial planning community looks at this particular case. The student's name is Joe, as you may well imagine, and he has a student loan with a balance of about $95,000 that has an interest rate of 2.4% over 20 years. That's pretty low, actually. He says, I save at least 18% of each paycheck for retirement and only pay the minimum on my student loan balance. If I have money left over at the end of a pay period, should I invest it or should I pay more against my student loan? Now, at the core of Joe's question is a challenge a lot of us face, I guess. Where should my next dollar go if I'm trying to make a decision? That assumes you have an extra surplus dollar. There are almost always competing priorities in any financial plan, and it can be pretty tricky to know which is really the best way to go. So, Joe, in fairness to him, I mean, I thought this was a little bit of an unusual story because he's in pretty solid financial position despite having a $95,000 debt balance for tuition. The interest rate on his student loan, as I kind of alluded to, is pretty low, and he got a pretty solid jump on saving for retirement already. Anyone who's under the age of 40 who's putting 18% of their paycheck away for retirement is doing a heck of a job. And I don't know whether that reflects a company match or not, but 18% is pretty solidly on the right track while making minimum payments on his debt. Well, if he has more money left over after a paycheck, he wants to know if it's better to invest it or to use it to pay down his debt faster. The short answer is to try to actually do both. I know that's an overly simplified answer, but if there's money left over at the end of the month, we generally recommend a split approach, and this is consistent with a couple of different financial planning firms which weighed in on this particular question. But dealing with debt can be emotional, and that's part of the problem is a lot of the motion, I said financial decision-making related to mortgages, for example, which are large debts, and other major debts like $100,000 for student loans. It's not just a question of what you think. It's also a question of how you feel. Even if the math shows that investing some of the money does make sense, some people may still really feel that they want to get rid themselves of that debt as soon as possible. A lot of people feel that way about that's an old-style view of paying down your mortgage as well. Everyone's situation is going to be different, of course, so there are a bunch of different questions, maybe four or five, that you can ask yourself before really deciding to pay down your student debt early. In other words, the answer may be a little more complex than just a yes or a no. The first thing that you ask yourself is to take a look at your general plan. And I want to know how making payments into your retirement for your retirement plan, how dealing with debt service, and dealing with just the regular obligations you have as a person who probably, if you're not a homeowner, you're certainly paying rent somewhere very likely. You probably have an automobile that you have to support and maintain. You're buying insurances of different kinds. And, of course, you're dealing with your regular discretionary spending that takes place in addition to your fixed costs. Make sure you have some cash set aside for emergencies. So establishing an emergency fund, if you haven't already done that, that's pretty darn important. And before you start getting aggressive paying down loans, especially loans that are under 3% in terms of cost, I said, I love the idea of paying down the loan. Don't get me wrong. If you have the ability to do it, go ahead and knock yourself out. But I do think that you should look at other elements of solid, reasonable, thoughtful planning. The first one we always ask is, do you have emergency capital on hand that's not designated for anything, but there's enough of it that you could deal with a standard emergency, like having to do major repairs on your automobile or some sort of a major appliance replacement at home? These things can cost thousands of dollars. Are you going to have to take on more debt, use a credit card that can be quite expensive, or something in order to deal with these emergencies? Now, I use the word emergency. Be careful. Sometimes what I call the nest egg fund, money, again, not designated for anything, maybe the nest egg fund is for also opportunities that might pop along. I'd hate for an opportunity to do something that might be really wonderful and special, and you not be able to take advantage of it because you didn't have the free capital to engage in it without having to take on unexpected debt. Make sure you have some cash set aside for those sorts of things. So start building up the emergency fund if you haven't done it already before starting to make additional loan payments. Now, if you find yourself facing unexpected medical bills, a car breakdown, as I mentioned, or a leaky roof at home, the emergency fund obviously is going to help keep you from having to take out even more debt. And that was the whole issue behind recommending it. Now, how much do you put aside for an emergency? My rule of thumb is to look at what your fixed expenses are. And take 3 months of fixed expenses. Now, this assumes you're a little bit younger. You know, so for somebody in their 20s, 30s, even early 40s, as you get older and closer to actual retirement, I'd like you to slowly increase the emergency fund, get it up closer to 6 months of fixed expenses. That's just a standard rule of thumb. Now, the next question you often ask yourself is, do I have savings put away? Have I been, now in the case of our study here, he's been putting away 18% of his pay for retirement. But retirement is the largest financial goal that you're going to deal with in your life. For the most people, that's true. So the question you're going to ask is, are you putting away an adequate amount of money for retirement? Have you actually sat down and done an analysis to determine what your future retirement needs might be and how much money you need to save at what rate of return and for how long to get there? That may do a lot of things. Not only may that assist you to know whether you're on track to actually have a financially independent retirement someday, but it may also give you sort of an inkling as to how long you might actually have to work before retirement is realistic. Again, that may not affect your decisions overall, but these are pieces of information. Knowing who you are financially will help you make better financial decisions, I promise. Now, as a young person in this particular case, time is on your side. Joe is already taking advantage of the power of compounding interest by setting aside 18% of his paycheck for retirement. That's a really great number. My rule early on, when a person first starts out saving for retirement, when you get your first full-time job, and especially if you have a company-sponsored plan, is to try to get your contribution to that plan upwards of as much as 10%. Now, that may be easier than some people think. Ask the people in your HR department who handle these programs for you. Ask them if there's a company match. Are they going to match some part of your contribution? Every plan may be a little bit different, but some of the common ones would say that they will match 50 cents on the dollar up to 6% of your pay. So if you're contributing 6% of your pay, they will contribute 3% for you. Now, that gets you up to 9%. So if you want to reach 10, if that's the goal that you have, and it's such a nice place to start, nice round number, I would suggest you elect to have 7% of your pay put aside, payroll withheld, and put right into your 401k or your 403b plan. Now, usually when there is a company match, it's a 401k. A great many 403bs do not match the contribution of the employee. 403bs are typically with not-for-profit entities. 401ks are usually for-profit corporations. Now, that said, again, if you put 7% in, they're matching 50 cents on the dollar up to 6, so they're going to put in 3 for you. You put in 7, and there's your 10% right there. And start that early. Get into the habit of putting that aside. Now, as you get raises and as your income goes up, have it structured so that your contribution to your 401k is, in fact, a percentage of your pay, so that if you get a raise at work, then you're actually going to automatically give your plan a raise as well. Now, if you're not setting aside as much as a case like Joe here is, there are many experts do suggest saving at least the 10% I mentioned, or enough to actually receive the full match from the company's 401k. Now, I would have said that as a caveat, meaning if you can't do the full 10%, at least put away 6%. To get, if the match goes up to 6, at least go that much. That way you'll at least be doing probably close to 9 with the match included. Retirement accounts like 401ks or even an individual retirement account, an IRA, that you set up, these are good places to start investing because there isn't a tax advantage, as we've mentioned many times here on this show. But remember, you generally won't be able to access your money before you retire without paying some sort of a penalty. In this case, it's the excise tax of a 10% penalty if you're under 59 and a half. So that's something to think about. Now, what are the rates and the interest rates on your debt? Now, in Joe's case, he had a very particularly low rate. He said his student loan rate was 2.4% interest rate on that student loan. Now, that's lower than when I look at student loans that my now adult children, but my children took out during their college years when we were looking at them. They were considerably higher. Some of them were as much as 5 and 6% at different points in time. Now, if there is such a thing as a good debt, a loan with a 2.4% fixed rate would actually fall into that category, in my opinion. Now, federal student loans currently charge an interest rate somewhere between 4 and 7%, so I guess my 6 wasn't too far off. Other debt is usually more expensive. The average interest rate on credit cards, for example, probably is in the 15, 16, 17% range. So, yeah, getting out of expensive debt like that is probably pretty important. If you do have other debts with those types of high interest rates, a number of financial planners suggest paying those out first. I'm sure that if you listen to Dave Ramsey here on AM 790 during the course of the average week, he would tell you that the first thing you do is find the really expensive debt, like the credit cards, and get rid of that stuff first, because it's really weighing you down, and it's putting pressure and restricting your ability to pay off other, maybe more progressive obligations that you might have. Now, a question that you also have to ask as part of this discussion is, when you are investing your capital, whether it's retirement planning or investing separately, such as an individual account, which you could do, what kind of a rate of return do you expect to get on your money? And that will be based upon the type of investing you do, your knowledge of the investment markets, how much risk you're willing to take, and of course, the time frame you have will have a big impact on that. So there's no crystal ball that can tell you how the stock market's going to perform in the future on any given moment. But we do know over time that there are some reasonable numbers that you can embrace without getting into too much trouble in terms of expectation. That's partly why making the decision to invest can be probably a little bit tougher than simply paying down debt. But the move to invest could pay off if your return ends up being greater than the interest that you're paying on debt. So I guess in the end, what you're doing with this decision is you're assigning a value to the money. Is the payment of the debt more valuable to you? Or is putting the money into some sort of reasonable investment program, is that more advantageous? We'll talk about that. I'll be back to get more discussion on this particular issue of debt management and balancing and measuring debt management against investment management. This is Don Sowa. This is the Money Talk program on AM 790, your home of talk and business. I'm going to be right back, so please stick around.
Sponsored by Tax Doctor. Owe the IRS $10,000 or more? Call the Tax Doctor to settle tax debt for less. 800-542-9112. 800-542-9112.
Everybody, let's go, ho, ho, ho! Welcome, everyone, to West High School Spring Fling! Hey, where we at? Where we at?
All right, I've gone through all the tracks. Just move through the beats. Do your thing.
All right, everyone, let's hear it for West High's own Brooke Turner, a.k.a. DJ Hook!
Scratching up my first school dance takes confidence. So getting into college, I've got what it takes. Okay, I went through the practice sessions. I slept good. I feel good.
We will now begin the test. Please take out your pencils.
I got this.
We're all good at something. Maybe it's breakdancing or skateboarding or video games. Whatever you're good at, you had the skills to make it happen. And those same skills will help us get to college. Visit knowhowtogo.org to learn what you should be doing right now to prepare for college. Start taking the steps at knowhowtogo.org.
I've got what it takes. So do you.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Hey, my name's Brant. You ever make a change and then wonder, why didn't I do this a long time ago? That's what's happening for thousands of people with regard to their health care. They're joining MediShare, and then they're wondering, why didn't I already do this? For most members, it costs less than half what they were paying for their old health plan. There's a huge provider network, too. You can customize your plan, and this is awesome, MediShare members can go online with a doctor 24/7, so if you need a prescription for the flu or something, it's so convenient for you and your family. So yeah, this is one of those why did I wait on this things, and if you don't love your current health plan, you're not stuck with it. You can join MediShare anytime. By the way, to give you an idea, the typical savings for a family, about $500 a month. It just makes so much sense. Check it out. They're super easy to talk to. Call 866-88-BIBLE. That's 866-88-BIBLE. 866-88-BIBLE.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we welcome you to the last segment of tonight's Money Talk program. This is Don Sowa. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to AM 790, your home of talk and business, and we're delighted that, to have you share your drive time home with me tonight. The primary topic of the second half of tonight's show dealt with this issue of balance, trying to answer the question that a caller called in, and this is a very common one. It deals with financial planning priorities or prioritization. Yeah, you have to know what things are most important. Time will be a big factor in how you prioritize. I mentioned there's not much, there's no computer program out there or crystal ball that can tell you, you know, which particular stock you should buy or how the market will perform at any given moment in time. But there are some standards that are never guaranteed, but they're not unreasonable for you to assume. Making assumptions is okay, as long as you don't get disappointed if your expectations are not timed out perfectly. Market timing is always a dangerous endeavor, trying to figure out the ultimate bottom if you want to buy low and the ultimate top if you want to sell high. It's really hard to do. So consistency and stability and balance is a very, very important part of all this. The move to invest your capital, the choice of should I take extra money and save it and invest it, or is it more prudent for me to take and increase the amount of money that I pay against outstanding debt that I have? Well, the move to invest could pay off for you if your return on your investment ends up being greater than the interest you pay on your debt. So in the case of a person carrying an extensive balance on credit cards in the 15 to 17% range, honestly, folks, I don't care what kind of return you got last year in 2017, it would probably have been an aberration. You may say, well, geez, you know, the return that I got was better or very close to what my credit card debt would be. Last year, that's a possibility, but historically, that wouldn't be the case. using reasonable numbers and assuming that over time, even though it won't occur each and every year, but over time you could come up with an average return in the 5 to 6.5% range in your portfolio, depending upon how you allocate your mix. But it's not an unreasonable expectation. There was a time historically when we might have said 9 or 10% was more realistic in a, especially an equity weighted portfolio. But now, with the economy growing at the current rate that it is, interest rates are relatively low. But with opportunities in the market and the growth rate of earnings in the in this market, it's not realistic to look at a 9 or 10% return. As I said, you will get individual years where that may occur, but you're more likely to be looking at an average closer to 5 or 6%. So if you want to find out which is a better choice, there are a lot of free online calculators right on your computer, or you could consult with a financial advisor. Obviously, Stephen, Donna Grace, and myself, we are biases, as we are all certified financial planner professionals. So we're suggesting that it might not be a bad idea, especially if you're in your formative planning phase, to actually sit down with a financial planning professional, financial advisor, and help them, have them walk you through some of the hypothetical situations that exist, some of the things that have worked well historically for people like you in the past. There are also student loan calculators out there. They allow you to actually see how much money you'll save over the long term by paying your student debt off faster. So in the case of the analogy we used, we had the gentleman Joe with about $95,000 of student loan debt outstanding, but only at 2.4%, so that's a very low yield. So that may skew the analogy we might normally want to use. But if he puts an additional $100 aside each month towards his student loan, or $1,200 a year, he'll pay off that debt about 4 years faster and pay about $5,300 less in interest because he was accelerating his payments on that 2.4% fixed loan. Now, if he invests, on the other hand, the $100 a month instead of paying it against debt, but puts it into his investment plan and assumes perhaps a 6% rate of return that we were talking about, he'll actually earn about $11,000 and have a total of about $30,000 invested over the same time period that it takes him to pay off the debt. So, a lot of different approaches to things in general. So, what are, you know, the question you might ask is, what are your most important or maybe your favorite money goals that you might have? So, when you're looking at the importance of debt, you have to list them in terms of their importance, in terms of your priorities. Ask yourself what your next big purchases are likely to be, your next big financial obligations, if you can actually quantify them. Will you need money for a new car purchase soon? How about the purchase of a new home? Or perhaps there's a wedding in your future, or there's children that you have to accommodate. Generally, if the expense is coming up within the next 2 years, say, many financial planners suggest keeping money for that purchase out of the stock market. Nothing that could be subject to the deviation that can occur within the stock portfolio. Over time, yes, the stock market will outperform almost all other categories of the market, typically, including bonds and cash. But in any one brief short period of time, you can't guarantee that the stock market couldn't have a correction or a sell-off during that period. And then if you would have looked back at that decision, said, geez, I should have just left the money in the money market, guaranteed, right? But if you don't need the money until later on, that's, like I said, it could be better idea to invest the money, not necessarily 100% in stocks, folks. No, I would not suggest that to really anybody. Because if you're going to go 100% into the market that way, go all in, then you are, I don't believe investing efficiently and thoughtfully the way we try to describe here on Money Talk, I don't believe it's a gamble. I don't equate that with Atlantic City or Vegas, although I've heard people talk about it that way. But it really is not. It's thoughtful. You're investing in the growth of companies that make up the U.S. economy. You become a partial or marginal interest owner. You become an owner of those companies. You're making a commitment to it. And hopefully as those companies grow and as they're profitable, you will share in some of that growth and profit through your stock ownership. You can own mutual funds or index portfolios, exchange-traded funds, inexpensive ways to invest that allow you a broad selection of companies within sectors that you believe will do well. So if you think that the technology sector will continue to do well here in 2018 and maybe 19, well, then there's plenty of different ways for you to participate in those specific sectors. If you do decide to invest, as I mentioned, be thoughtful and make sure that your portfolio reflects who you are by that combination of stocks and bonds. Or if you want a broad diversity, don't put all of your eggs in one basket. And yeah, use exchange-traded funds or mutual funds. There are a number of wonderful index funds, which, of course, can be bought through ETFs as well. You're going for a very low-cost approach to investing. If you're doing the investing yourself and you're not paying a financial advisor, then you owe it to yourself to go with no load and very low cost options. And you want to get some exposure to a diversified mix of stocks and bonds within your mix. But if you can afford to invest and make additional student loan payments simultaneously, we suggest that to yourself. I mean, this analogy, an extra $100 a month in Joe's case would have knocked over $5,000 of interest payments out of his lifetime of debt service on that and paid the thing off 4 or 5 years earlier. That's a wonderful idea. And the other side of that is when you get to the end of the cycle, when the loan is paid off, because you were also putting $100 a month away into a diversified investment plan, you now suddenly have a lot more capital available for other programs and projects that may be important to you, other goals that may be part of your mix. So, like I said, the balanced approach probably is best, but if you have to make a choice one way or another, you make the choice that is most sensible, and that would be the one that derives the greatest benefit overall. If the interest payment on the debt is extremely high, then that's probably the way to go. Get rid of that really ridiculous, especially credit card-related debt. But if you're like our example here, Joe, he's got a 2.4% loan, anything like that, 3% or less, is a very, very cheap money. And in a case like that, you may want to actually consider investing capital on the side in at least meeting your financial obligations to the lender. Don't ever be late on your payments, and make sure you honor that obligation going forward. This is all about your credit quality as well. Hey, folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. Thanks for tuning in tonight. Tomorrow's Friday. Steve Bovee will be here at 5 o'clock with more Money Talk to close out the week. I hope you'll be here, too. In the meantime, you have a great evening.
When you're hiring, you don't want to sort through dozens of irrelevant resumes. You want a short list of qualified candidates. That's why you need Indeed.com. Diana's hired with Indeed.
It just gives me so many more.